Welcome to the Cigar Lounge, the official podcast of the Cigar Peg, where you get to know your friends a little better, learn a little bit more about each other, and grow as a community. Welcome to the Cigar Lounge. Today, we have Frank King, the mental comedian. Frank, how are you today?
That'd be the mental health comedian, although I am mental, Joe. You are correct.
I know. I just kind of left out a word.
Yeah. Not important. Not important.
Frank. So tell Frank, the mental health comedian, tell us a little bit about what you do.
I speak on suicide prevention as a workplace health and safety priority. Reason being, 80% of people who die by suicide are age 18 to 65. And where are they pretty much every day? At work. Okay. I speak to half a dozen industries in the U.S. that have the highest rates of suicide. I also coach TEDx. I help people get TEDx talks. I have 8 TEDx talks my own self. And I occasionally do stand-up comic, on cruises if I'm going to do comedy.
Well, let's start with stand-up comedy because I'm assuming that that somehow is where your career began. Am I correct?
Yes. Good assumption, Joe. Yes. Ninth grade, 9 years old, fourth grade, told a joke, kids laughed, teacher was hysterical, decided at 9 years old, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. I did a 12th grade senior talent show. I won. Of course, I beat, an accordion player and folk dancers, not that tough doing stand-up. And then wanted to go to LA immediately. And my mom said, you're going to college first. I don't care what you do when you get done. You can be a goat herder for all I care, but you're going to be a goat herder with a college degree. So I went to UNC Chapel Hill, picked up a couple of college degrees, boom, off to the West Coast. And in my first open mic night, halfway through my 5 minutes, inside my head, I heard a voice, you're home.
Nice.
Well, I decided I was going to do it for a living. And 18 months later, I said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 35 years, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comedian. Would you like to come along for the ride? Figuring she'd go, oh, hell no. She goes, yeah. So we gave up the apartment, our jobs, jumped into my tiny Dodge Colt, and we were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, no home, 7 years and change.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And your tour, North America, Canada, anywhere it took you? Or?
Yes, pretty much. I never made it to Canada. Canada's got a bunch of clubs called Yuck Yucks. Yeah. And I worked the entire time I was on the road to get into Yuck Yucks, and I never got over that hump, but that's okay. And then I began doing cruise ships a little bit during that tour, and worked with Rosie and Ellen, Seinfeld, Dennis Miller, Foxworthy, Ron White.
Now, when you say you worked with, you wrote for people, correct?
Yes, I wrote jokes for The Tonight Show for about 20 years.
Okay.
For Leno, when he was first just the permanent guest host, and then when he got the job for real, I was contract labor, writing on spec. And he let most of the contract labor go when he got the job, for real. But he kept some of us on. So I wrote for the show until he left for CNBC and Jay's Garage.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And when was that? I don't know. Timing-wise, that's what...
I think he left NBC to go to CNBC sometime around 2010.
So about 10 years. I'm close. Okay. I knew it was somewhere in that range. You said you moved to the West Coast. Where's your origin? Where are you from?
Born and raised North Carolina. Went to school in Chapel Hill. Go Heels.
All right. Now, so what transitioned you from this world of comedy and driving all over the place into wanting to be a speaker? How did that happen?
Well, after the road tour came to an end, I got hired to do a morning show. During the 1990s, there was a trend. They were hiring comics to be sidekicks on morning shows. And so I got an offer from the number one morning show in my old hometown, Raleigh. And so I took it. And I drove a number one morning show to number 6 in 18 months. And a friend of mine said, you didn't drive it in the ground. You drove it into Middle Earth.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And then my act had always been very clean, Joe. So I thought I'll be a corporate comic, join the National Speaker Association Carolinas chapter, And every now and then.
When was this? Where are we looking at?
95.
Okay, go ahead.
Yep. 95. And people ask me, what's the difference between a club comic and a corporate comic? About $5,000 a day plus travel. So I'm no math major, but that made sense. Because not every comic can do corporate because you got to be HR friendly.
Yep.
And I did that till 2007. And I was making $5,000 for 45 minutes just being funny and making sure the HR person didn't lose their job. And then the recession hit and speaking and corporate comedy dropped off about 80%. And
yep.
My wife and I lost everything in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And that's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. Literally. Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. A friend of mine came up after a keynote recently and goes, hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger? I said, hey, man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when speaking came back, Joe, meeting planner said to me in a speaker's bureau, Frank, we love you. We can't pay you $5,000 anymore just to be funny. You have to teach the audience something. And so I had no idea. I always wanted to do that. I always wanted to be a speaker, you know, make a living and a difference.
Right, right.
A friend of mine, Judy Carter, speaker, once a comic magician, wrote a book called The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. So she gave me a copy and said, read this. And you, trust me, she said, if you read this, you'll figure out where you need to be, what you need to be speaking on. So I thought, I got nothing. About halfway through, I thought, oh, my gosh. Given my close brush with suicide, I live with two mental illnesses. There are more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd. I thought I could speak on suicide prevention if I got some training and got some, you know, accreditation in suicide prevention. So I took a couple of suicide prevention courses. And the other hurdle, Joe, was comic, 2.5 decades. Who's going to believe I can do anything serious? So that's when my wife suggested, do a TEDx talk. And I said famously, what's a TEDx talk? And happened to get an invitation that week from one in British Columbia simply to apply. So I applied and I got it.
Okay.
And then after that one posted on YouTube, two other ones came to me and said, do you have any more mental health ideas? And I did. I did two more by invitation than the last five. I guess last four I applied for. And the eighth one that I just did, they found me on LinkedIn and asked me to do one virtually for a TEDx in the state of Assam, India. So nice. I just did my eighth TEDx talk.
When was this? Just
last month.
Oh, okay. So that recent. So with all these TED talks now, I know you coach people in TEDx talks. Somewhere along the line, did you figure out a formula where you could turn a TEDx talk into income?
That's a question I get oftentimes. I cannot draw a straight line from a TEDx to a booking. I'm honest with my students about that. Sure. I said, however, you know, if you're up against another speaker or two in your topic area and the meeting planner is looking at your website and theirs and you have a TEDx talk, you know, it might give you a leg up. Somebody somewhere, a third party group had said, this is a great idea. This guy's good. So credibility, a little marketability, some visibility, and it makes a great piece of your sizzle reel.
Sure.
And those big red letters still have some cachet.
Nope, it always looks good out there. Now, let me back up here because I'm going to think about, here we are today, years after you decided to go on the road. And if you could go back to the day you left to go on the road for 2,000 days, would you have done something different if you could go back in time?
Yes. The one thing I would have done differently, I was impersonating John Edwards, the former presidential and vice presidential candidate.
Okay.
And John Stewart, the Daily Show, called me and said, would you come on as John Edwards? And a friend of mine, I didn't watch the Daily Show at the time. A friend of mine said, Frank, it's they're not serious about interviewing. It's kind of a spoof. They're gonna, you know, poke fun at you and so forth. And so I called him and I essentially turned it down. And I think that was a mistake. Because, you know, being on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart at that point in time would have probably launched me. Then again, Joe, Edwards ended up sleeping with Rael Hunter. Right. Yeah. And I said, when that happened, he screwed two people, her and me, because he would have probably been Obama's first choice for VP if that hadn't happened. He was on the short list. So I could have impersonated Edwards for 2 4-year terms while he was VP and 2 4-year terms maybe while he was president. That's retirement money right there.
True story.
So if I could go back in time, I would just have gone right along with the Daily Show and played along, you know.
Jumped into the Daily Show and then became John Edwards' campaign manager to make sure he stayed in office.
Yeah, well, he and I look a lot alike. We're from not far from each other in North Carolina. We were at UNC Chapel Hill together. He was in law school. I was undergrad. I didn't know him.
Right.
But we look quite a bit alike. I wouldn't have had to do any prosthetics.
There you go.
Just the hair. But other than that.
Well, so what is it that every day in your life, what wakes you up in the morning? What makes you want to do what you're doing? What motivates you?
My goal is to save a life a day.
Okay.
When I speak, I'm on stage. I tell my story. Men don't tend to come out and talk about things emotional or mental. So seeing a guy up on stage, being vulnerable, sharing a story, getting choked up, gives other people permission to give voice to their feelings and experiences. They line up after my show and they want to tell me a story or share a story. And most of them start like this. I've never told anybody this. Well, I get that a lot. Because even though one person dies by suicide every 11 minutes in the U.S., hardly anybody talks about it unless you bring it up. And then almost everybody's got a story.
Have you ever had a situation where someone knows who you are and reaches out to you because they're about to do something stupid?
Yes. I give out my cell number. Every keynote, I say to them, look, if you're suicidal, call the 3-digit suicide hotline, 988. If you're just having a bad day, call a crazy person. Here's my cell. And people call. A guy called me one day. We're chatting. I think he's on the cusp of dying by suicide. And he says to me, yeah, I picked up an Amtrak schedule. Well, a lot of people wouldn't pick up on this, but it occurred to me he's probably going to step in front of a train. So I said to him, look, I'm not going to ask you not to kill yourself. That's not my jam. What I am going to ask you to do is not do it that way, because the moment you step on those tracks, you're probably going to lock eyes with the engineer. You're going to die and his or her life will never be the same. So, please don't do it that way. I don't know if he ever died by suicide. I don't know if he ever got hit by a train, but yeah, every now and then somebody calls me and they're on the cusp.
That's intense. All right. I figured that had to happen with your message, but that's a lot to handle.
But since I have perspective, I've had people tell me, look, I've been in therapy for 2 years. My therapist is fabulous, got all the diplomas on the wall, but they have no context. Go listen to your 45-minute keynote. I'm back there thinking, this guy's inside my freaking head. That's the benefit. That's what I bring to the table. I had a psychologist say to me one time, Joe, what qualifies you to speak on suicide prevention? You're not a psychologist, a psychiatrist. Hell, you're not even a therapist. I said, because I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like. I said, you're a psychologist. I can go to school. I can learn everything you know. You will never know everything I know. And that pretty much shut him up.
That works. Who in the speaking world, when you started to dabble into it, did you have people that you considered to be your mentors and your supporters?
Judy Carter.
Other than Judy, you mentioned Judy,
Judy became a friend. I joined the Carolinas chapter of NSA. There have been a number of people in NSA through the years that have been, although I began as a comic in NSA, that's not the most popular, because in San Diego when I joined, I was simply doing comedy and everybody had a message. Everybody was trying to change the world. My tagline at the time, Joe, was as a comedian, make a living, not a difference. All I want to do is make a living. Everybody else is making a difference. Mark LeBlanc, who became president of NSA.
Okay.
Was a mentor. Yep. Cause he had joined the San Diego chapter about the same time I did and was working his way up the leadership, the chain of command. Ed Rigsby.
Okay.
Recently, and I joined ASSC, the Association Society, Community of Speakers, this time last year, January.
Okay.
Best marketing money I've ever spent.
Very good to hear. And Ed will be happy, says a little commercial for Ed Rigsby.
Yeah.
as you went into the speaking world, what in the speaking world was not what you thought it would be? What did you go and say, oh my God, this is not what I thought?
Actually, it wasn't so much not what I thought. The difficult part for a comedian going and becoming a speaker, because, you know, you're both on stage, mm-hmm. was the silence. I'm used to, as a comic, a laugh every 9 to 12 seconds, feedback every 9 to 12 seconds.
Yep.
And as a speaker, I realized they're all paying attention, but they're very quiet. And it was a little unnerving in the beginning, all that silence. My brain's going, crack a joke, crack a joke, crack a joke. You know, I'm hooked on the feedback. And right. now it's not a big deal because I've been doing it for, let's see, 10 years, I guess, 10 years since my first speech.
Yeah, I know. Yep.
14, 8 years since my first TEDx. So yeah, it's much more comfortable now. But I didn't realize how difficult it would be to go from comic to speaker until I'm on stage and they're paying attention. They're really interested in what I have to say, but.
I know that feeling. You know, it's a reaction and I understand it. And I think it's for people to appreciate it. It's when you're a comic, the audience reaction is how you know they're listening. As a speaker, when they're quiet and looking at you, they're listening. And that's a hurdle.
Yes. And one of my finest days in speaking, I was in New York City in Manhattan in a building, in a 50-story building that was under construction, doing a suicide prevention speech for construction workers on site. And the meeting planner said to me afterwards, he said, Frank, I noticed something. I don't know if you noticed, but by the time you were 10 minutes into your keynote, not one person in the room was looking at their phone.
Yep.
I didn't realize that was a metric, but I thought, man, what a compliment that they, you know, they stopped looking at their phones.
Well, okay. So other than tasting the barrel of a gun, if you could do your career over, what changes would you make? What would you do different? What would you be doing differently today?
I tried being a dirty comic for a little while.
Okay.
And it cost me 12 weeks of work with the improvs. I was auditioning for the improv comedy clubs and did a dirty set. And the guy said, look, come back when you've got a clean 10 minutes. Had I done my clean 10 minutes, which I certainly had, I would have gotten that work right away. That would have made my life easier for quite some time because those are great clubs. The reason I stopped doing dirty comedy, I met a guy in Vegas, old guy, you know, an old guy, old, big old fat guy who was working in Vegas. He's in a tuxedo, talks like this. He goes, hey, kid, don't do the dirty comedy. You don't have the face for it. And he was absolutely right. So I would have skipped that portion of my experimentation in comedy, Joe, and stuck with the clean.
All right. Well, you know, okay, so we call that experimentation. Let me ask you this. And I realized that would have doing that or trying to be dirty was a mistake. What would you say was the biggest mistake that you've made in your career? I mean, I know you've already said turning down the John Edwards piece or.
Yep.
I'm talking as a businessman, business-wise, where you went, oh my God, I made a mistake here.
I had a job on radio in the 90s, 93, 94, 95. What I did not realize, Joe, was that was the end of personality-driven morning radio because of the Telecommunications Act, I think it was 85, Reagan was in. They allowed companies to own more than one FM, more than one AM in a market. And so what was happening was the people that owned radio stations were selling them to the Clear Channels of the world.
Right.
And the Clear Channels of the world were run by hedge fund managers who didn't give a rat's ass about personality-driven radio. All they cared was just put a warm body in the seat or bring it in by satellite from somewhere else. I didn't realize that. So when I got to Oregon, a friend of mine said, we're going to do an afternoon drive comedy talk show. The idea was we would do a good enough job. We would get hired to do a morning show, which is where the money is in radio.
Right.
The shift in radio where the money is the morning show. And we had a great afternoon drive, funny talk show. But I didn't realize that no matter how good it was, there was no way any radio station in town was going to pay me even what I made back in 95. I realized later when I met some people that worked at a what they call a radio cluster bunch of stations here in town. Most of them were doing two shifts under two different names on two different stations and making less than I was making in 95 doing one shift.
Yep.
I didn't realize the world had moved on, that the radio, is, as I knew it, was done.
Yeah. Well, and I'm laughing because I know someone that did two shifts on the radio. And I was one of the only people that I was in the same building. So I knew it was him on both shifts. So let me ask you, as you mentioned this, you called it personality driven radio. I that's a term, I got to be honest, I never heard it before. Will you share with us, what does that mean?
Well, if you live in a town for some time and, you know, back in the day, listen to a morning show on the way to work. Or maybe it was your alarm. You had a radio alarm clock and it came on. It was, good morning, everybody. It's Bob and Phil with the most major markets had a radio show. Number one, generally, Bob and Tom was okay. A radio show. Indianapolis is where they started. They had one station. They eventually were syndicated in who knows how many. Charlotte, North Carolina had John Boy and Billy. So it was a radio show. You tuned in because you felt like they were your friends, because you spent every morning, and they would be out in the community doing, you know, good work in the community, also doing remotes where they go out to a bar and they're giving away prizes and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's where personality, it's not the music. And Bob and Tom out of Indianapolis was a rock station,
right? But
on their morning show, they rarely played any music unless they, you know, got jammed up and didn't have something. Maybe the guest didn't show. So they play a song while they regrouped. So it wasn't, and the show I did in Raleigh, we didn't have to play a lot of music. If we had something funny to say or something interesting to say, we didn't have to play whatever song was supposed to come next. We just, you know, blew right through it.
So it was more about the people than about the information. And now we're in an information age.
Information and music. When I got a job briefly with the same station a year or so later doing an evening shift, and the guy flat told me, Frank, it's not about you. It's not about personality. It's about the music. Just announce the song and put it on.
Got it.
But see, you can get a guy who just got out of college, pay a minimum wage to do that. And also now they do something called voice track, where if the shift is 3 hours long, the DJ goes in and records all the breaks between songs in an hour. And then puts it, you know, in a file, digital file. And that night, you really can't tell that he's or she's not there. They're coming in after the song finishes and then introducing the next song, or, you know, they give a time check. So it's called voice tracking. So you can, you know, you pay them for 1 hour's work when it's a 3 hour show. Bottom line.
Nope. That's what it's about, making money for them. Let me ask you this. And please don't answer with don't pull the trigger. What is the single most important lesson you've learned in your career?
In my career speaking or in comedy? Or
I don't care. The career of being who you are.
Oh, know your audience.
Okay. And talk about that a little, because, I mean, as a comedian, you get people to laugh. And I think your answer to that question is something people might learn from.
Yes, because.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When you say, know your audience, what do you do to know your audience?
Well, you know, it depends on where you are. If you're in a club, the rules are different, although it's a little tighter now because of the woke folks. But when I started in comedy, it was just a comedian on stage with a microphone and the First Amendment. And you could pretty much say anything you wanted to say. And part of a comedian's job is to speak truth to power and push the envelope. That's the way it used to be. And so if people got offended, they didn't, you know, trash you on social media. There was no such thing. They just got their money back at the box office. But club audience is one thing. And if it's, you know, if it's a lot of people who are dating, then you want to make sure that any joke you tell with a woman in it, the woman wins, because guys who are dating will look at the woman they're dating, see if she's laughing often before they'll laugh. If it's a corporate audience, there, you know, you can only go so far. I might do a double entendre or some, you know, some play on words, but deep into the act after they already like me, you know, I can be a bad little boy after they come to like me. But you've got a friend of mine called me and said, should I book this comic for a corporate gig? And I said, he's not a corporate comic. And my friend said, yep, he's got 45 minutes of clean material, he said. And I said, I bet he does. The problem is, if his clean material is not going well, he's going to reach and pull the dick joke parachute.
Yep.
And my friend went to the event, standing in the back of the room. It was not going well. He said, Frank, I swear to God, I could see his hand reaching for the ring to pull the dick joke parachute.
Oh, that's funny.
I'm at the back going, no, 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 no. And sure enough, he pulled it. And my friend lost the client because the comic was, he's a clean comic, but not a corporate clean. When meeting planners push back on my $5,000 fee for being funny, they go, 45 minutes of jokes, $5,000. Oh, you're not paying me for the jokes I tell. You're paying me for the jokes I don't tell and the wisdom to know the difference. You're paying me so when I get done my job, you still have a job. That's knowing the audience. That's knowing how much you can get away with. Cruise ship, you got people in the audience who are 8 to 80. So everybody's got to have a generally good time. Nobody get offended.
Perfect. Thank you. Let me ask this question, which is, if someone said to you, here, Frank King, I will pay you $1 million a year to not be a speaker or a comedian, what would you do with your life? What would you, what kind of career would you start?
I wouldn't. I would stay home and walk the dogs. I wouldn't leave my driveway, Joe. Or
go all right. No, yeah, that's why I just wanted to know. All right. Yeah,
I would cancel all my social media accounts. I would turn in my iPhone and get a flip phone that does nothing but make phone calls, take the occasional picture. I would disappear. People would never even know what happened to me.
There you go. All right. Is there any other occupation in life where you went, oh, I wish I could have tried that?
I did attempt during the last recession when there was no work for speakers to speak of. I auditioned or tried out with 12 police departments in the state of Washington. I always wanted to be a cop.
Okay.
And I was 52, but they can't discriminate based on age if you pass the law enforcement physical fitness test. And at 52, I passed it 4 different times, the oldest person in the state of Washington ever to pass. And I came this close to being a Seattle police officer. I was on the short list.
Okay.
My training officer said, you know, Frank, you haven't done anything wrong. It's just a lot of young people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, I mean, 3 years ago, nobody wanted these jobs.
Right, right.
We would have taken a chance on a 52-year-old guy going to the academy, but we just have too many recruits, potential recruits. And I mean, I passed the polygraph. By the way, there's a question on the polygraph, and apparently it's been in the polygraph test for 30 years. And it's this. They group the questions, driving record, drug and alcohol record, sexual history.
Right.
In the sexual, you're not supposed to joke around. You're not supposed to laugh or ask questions. But the polygrapher said to me, Frank, have you ever had sex with a farm animal, comma, if only by accident? I said, stop. I said, I understand the first part of the question. I really do. It's the disclaimer that fascinates me. I said, the whole bit about only by accident. Are you getting Eastern, big strapping Eastern Washington farm boys in here who can't get past this question? I swear to God, Your Honor, the sheep just kept backing up.
Yeah.
So I passed that. I passed the background check.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I passed that. You know, so I could have been a Seattle police officer, but it just, you know, wasn't meant to be.
Well, Frank, so people on this Cigar Pack, we all know because you were the auctioneer this year. So many people have seen you and we've seen you in all the calls. But if someone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get a hold of Frank King?
The Mental Health Comedian. That's my brand, The Mental Health Comedian.
And if they go to your website, all your contact information is right there for them.
That is correct. And by the way, Joe, I still think I have a career in law enforcement. Here's why. I have a hobby. And I didn't know it was a thing until a magician friend of mine told me it was. I like to guess where people are from. And my friend of mine goes, Frank, it's called a cold read.
Yep.
Mentalists do it all the time. And I've been doing it for years. And I mean, about 75% of the time, I'm dead on. And then 25% of the time, completely wrong. But when I'm dead on, Joe, it's frightening to people.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I'm going to take Paul Eckert's course, the guy that was there's a show called Lie to Me.
Yeah.
Loosely based on Dr. Paul Eckert's life. And it's about micro expressions and how you know when people are lying. So I think someday I'm going to be a police consultant You know, we bring them in for the interrogation, and this is our human lie detector. Now go ahead and tell us what happened. Because again, I love the datelines of 48 hours. Yep. As I'm listening and the person's in the, being interrogated, I'm walking up the hill with the dogs going, liar, liar. And about 75% of the time, I'm right. He did kill her or whatever it was. So,
well, so, sometime you and I'll have to have a discussion about how I believe all that micro expression training will mess you up. But that's another day. We'll have that. So, Frank, last question. What do you have this year? Something brand new that you're working on as we go into 2023. What are you looking for? Something new on your whiteboard that you're going to make happen this year? Anything?
I have divided my coaching. I used to do a combination of TEDx coaching and make money speaking coaching together.
Yep.
And I realized, Joe, that some people want TEDx and some people want to make money speaking, but it's not always the same individual. So I've divided it into TEDx coaching. Great. Or make money speaking coaching, or you can buy a combination if you like, but I didn't realize there was a market for either. So that's my push this year. And funny you should ask. Yesterday, I believe I sold my first standalone TEDx coaching. Raised my fee, by the way.
All right.
And today, I believe I sold my first standalone make money speaking. So it's awesome. The beta test. It worked.
Good. And we wish you a lot of luck in the new endeavor. And I want to just say to Frank, thank you for joining us in the Cigar Lounge today.
My pleasure, Newman. Looking forward to it.
All right. And everybody, thank you for joining us. And again, that was Frank King in the Cigar Lounge. And we thank you, our listener members. Please join us every 2 weeks as we drop a new episode, placing another Cigar Peg member in the spotlight of the Cigar Lounge.